The only way to get violence over violence is to somehow slowly use conversation, use understanding, use psychology, if you like, use patience, until you get to the point where you make sure there's no violence to be followed. I think at the end of the day, the problem is between the Israeli and the Palestinian, and it's the Israeli and the Palestinian that have to deal with the situation directly amongst themselves, between them. And I think that Israel...
Like in their own time, without foreign pressure.
Unfortunately, in their own time. I mean, you have to go through the process. You have to...
It's been 60 years, though.
But things can go on for hundreds of years in this part of the world, right?
All right, new episode of Young and Eve. I have a new guest. Who are you?
Sari Nusseibi. I'm Palestinian. I'm a Jerusalemite. And have lived in Jerusalem for the most part of my life.
Are we in Jerusalem right now?
Yes, we're in Jerusalem. We're in the eastern part of Jerusalem. We're on the edge of east and west Jerusalem.
So we're on the in the occupied territory.
Absolutely.
It doesn't feel occupied.
No, because this was annexed as soon as it was occupied. It came under Israeli law. And the laws that exist in East Jerusalem are totally different from the laws that exist in the rest of the occupied territories. Nonetheless, I would say about 90-95% of the Palestinians living in East Jerusalem are not Israelis. So we're not Israelis. We have just residence. We've been given residence cards or rights. And we are treated like an occupied people.
Well, you are, right?
Of course, yes.
How are the laws in East Jerusalem different from the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, in 1967, when Israel came to occupy everything, West Bank, Gaza, they basically extended their own laws to apply to an enlarged East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So they enlarged each East Jerusalem, the area, till up to about 70 square kilometers. From about 10 or 12, I can't remember exactly. And then they applied Israeli law. Now, that means basically that they were the masters of everything that you can do here, including, you know, everything from the small thing to the large thing. And we were just given residence rights. But, you know, if you hear about what they're doing here in terms of squeezing us in small or very small areas for building zones. Mm-hmm. What they do when we try to build houses for ourselves, you'll realize that we're basically living under a lot of pressure by a foreign power. So, yes, we're living here. We have some rights as residents. We can travel around. We can go to Tel Aviv, for instance. We can work in Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. People in the West Bank cannot cross over. Mm-hmm. At the moment, and we're not subject to the laws of the or regulations of the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah.
So, if you know, did a crime here, who would be?
That's totally unthinkable.
But like, let's imagine you were a criminal. Like, who would be responsible for you? The IDF? Is it military law?
Not the military, not the IDF. Although, of course, the IDF is used everywhere, including in Jerusalem. Yeah. But you're basically under the law of the land, of the country of Israel, of the state of Israel.
Yeah. So civil law,
but you can actually be, I mean, I was taken once for administrative detention.
You were in jail for three months.
That's right. I was let out after 3 months, but that was under something that the British actually had set up during the mandatory period. And the Israelis, when they established themselves as a country, went on using and are still using and misusing. Now, what does that administrative mean? It means that you can be picked up, you can just be thrown into the prison cell. You can be accused of all kinds of things without having the right to defend yourself, not even know what the charges are. And some people can spend, you know, the 3 months or 6 month period of a detention can be extended continually. Some people have actually stayed in jail under that definition for years and years. Mm-hmm. That's just one way of dealing with this.
Okay, so civil law applies for people in East Jerusalem.
So civil law applies, but when the need arises, you can be picked up and treated as the at the whim of the Israeli army or Israeli government.
So when I got in, your house seems to be very old, looks very historical, looks very nice. Have they ever tried to kick you out or like buy you out or, you know, force you out?
They haven't yet dared to do so, but it's something that happens to people all the time. Mm-hmm. They might have their eyes set on places here or around me. I wouldn't put it past them. But it hasn't happened yet, and I'm here. And I've been here, you know, for many, many years.
You feel safe?
I don't actually feel safe, to tell you the truth. I feel that we're under constant worry and concern because one never knows exactly what Israel has up its sleeve to do next.
That's crazy.
Hier ist Tyler, hier kommt die Werbung. Für uns selbst. Kommerzfreier Journalismus seit 2013 nur möglich durch deine Unterstützung. Schau in die Infos wie.
Like we went to Jericho last night.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have shawarma with my team. Mm-hmm. And I took them to my favorite shawarma place in the middle of Jericho. We just started dinner and then the IDF came in like with 10 Humvees or something. Mm. And they were shooting and like probably looking for someone or some people, and they like brought a huge surveillance drone, like they were shouting, shooting in there, like tried to intimidate me because like I was trying to film it, and then like a soldier pointed at me and like said, stop. And then like it felt like for 30 minutes life stopped, and there was like a sense of terror in the air, and then they vanished. Apparently, I guess they didn't find anyone. And then like 1 minute later, like life went on. Like the Palestinians, they were just like, yeah, all right, it's over. Everything is fine. And we were like still like kind of under shock because like this happened for the first time. And it was just so amazing to see people so kind of relaxed and seemingly feeling that this is nothing special. And then we talked to people and they were like, well, this happens every week, at least or twice a week. And this is unbelievable. But that's the West Bank, that's Jericho.
That's the West Bank. But, you know, every now and again, you have problems here in Jerusalem. Is it demonstrations? Is it confrontations between Jews and Arabs? Is it I don't know what? We have a place across the road from here, which is called Tombs of the Kings.
Yeah, it's owned by the French.
Well, it's owned by the French, but contested by various Jewish groups. And I think it was a couple of months ago they had major things over there. Before that, we had down there in Sheikh Jarrah in houses. I don't know if you heard. It was last year, I think, mm-hmm. 2 years ago. There again, major confrontations between the army and settlers and between the Palestinians and their supporters because of the attempt to take over those houses. So yes, I mean, but what can you do? You live, you're worried, you're never sure what's going to happen, but you have to live. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, what you saw in Jericho is exactly that. I sometimes try to go to Jericho, for instance, and I'm never sure when I go, if there's going to be a roadblock.
There was a roadblock yesterday.
Yeah.
Like they were looking for someone, I guess. Like they were searching every car.
But they do it every day. I mean, it comes and goes. Mm. So one day you go and you can go all the way from Jerusalem to Jericho in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And one day you go, you get stopped at the roadblock, either going in or coming out, and you can be there for 2 or 3 hours. So it's very uncertain, everything.
Okay, I sent our videos to like some Israeli colleagues, journalists, and they were like, okay, what happened? And I was like, well, can you like ask the IDF? Like, okay, I sent you the location, the time, what happened, ask them. And they were like, it's not, they won't answer. They won't comment. Like, unless someone got shot and you have like a, you know, picture or something, they won't even come out and say.
You have to look into the number of roadblocks. I mean, there are many, many roadblocks. I think maybe over, I don't know how many, but, you know, on the way to villages, to towns, to cities, coming in and out throughout the West Bank. So sometimes it just takes, if the roadblock is stationary there for 24 hours, so it can take, you know, hours and hours and hours for people to cross from one place to another. And sometimes they're not stationary, they come and go, like the one in Jericho. Mm-hmm. And so that also is something, you know, that makes you feel you can't organize your day or your life properly or normally.
I mean, you're a philosopher, and my question regarding if you feel safe under occupation was kind of a philosophical question, because, I mean, can you ever feel safe being occupied by a...
No, but...
Because actually, like, the occupied army is supposed to, protect the civilians who are occupied, right?
We're looked upon as enemies, and we're looked upon as potential terrorists, and we're looked upon as a sour presence in a country that. People believe, many people on the Israeli side believe, we don't have a right to be in. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, looking ahead and looking around, you always wonder whether, you know, the next step will come. You saw what they're doing in Gaza, what they did, back in 48. So, you know, even in 67, pushing people out of here. And so looking ahead, you're always worried that this will be happening again and again because of the drive to establish a kind of primarily Jewish state. Mm-hmm. So with as few Palestinians as possible.
I mean, you mentioned like potential terrorism. I mean, you were born in 1949. Been around for a long time. You've seen every aspect of the occupation. Was there ever a point in your life where you thought about, like, okay, I'm going to fight. I'm going to, you know, do more than nonviolent resistance? Like a young guy, we're like...
You know, sometimes in roadblocks, sometimes the people that try to overtake you out of order, and they drive all the way past to the front. Mm-hmm. And when you become very fed up, you think to yourself, I wish I had a gun with nails and I can shoot their tires and puncture them. Mm-hmm. So horrible thoughts like this, of course, you know, exist. Mm-hmm. You cannot deny them. Mm-hmm. But I only sort of think about them if I do at all, theoretically. And I've always thought right from the beginning that the only way to deal with what we have at our hands is through peaceful means.
Nonviolent.
Nonviolent, of course.
Why?
Because at the end of the day, this is how things can end, how the conflict can end. You can use violence, but the violence doesn't end it. Not in all situations, of course. I mean, in some cases, you go and kill somebody and they're gone.
Yeah.
But here, in this case, and this is just one example, you have a large population, Palestinian population, backed up by a larger, much larger Arab population. And we're living side by side, you know, foot by, or next to foot, if you like, with the Israelis. And it just can't be done by one party totally disappearing the other, mm-hmm. through violence. So we have to find a way to live together. However ugly that they might look to you at the moment, you have to see beyond that. You must look for the humanity in the other. And you're surprised.
I was just thinking about like someone like Ben-Gvir or Smotrich. Like, how can you see the humanity in someone like Minister Ben-Gvir or Smotrich?
You know, a lot of people who like that are not sort of born like that necessarily. They don't necessarily want to be like that. People, you know, end up being criminals or end up being psychotic or whatever. But Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are a few people. They do not represent. I've lived here now for many years, as you just pointed out, and I've come to know many, many Israelis from different angles, different points of view. And I'm sure many Israelis have come to know many Palestinians and you know, have seen beyond what they saw to begin with, the image that they have of the other. I think that it's possible. And if it's difficult, nonetheless, it's necessary. I mean, it's necessary to try and continue, if you like, trying to find a way to get an understanding of the other side.
What about, like, I mean, from a German point of view, many people are horrified by Hamas. Can you see humanity, like, in what Hamas is doing?
Now, that's a very difficult question. Yes, I mean, you know, I don't see what Hamas is doing as being humanistic or humanitarian. And I don't see what the Israelis, a lot of what they do as you know, humanitarian either. But the point is to look beyond this, to look into this deeper and to think, you know, what made them like this? Can we find a way to get over it? And this is the real challenge, I think. The real challenge is to get two people fighting, each one of them for their existence, against the other, is to get the two sides to see how they can coexist with one another.
How?
Well, do you know Shahrazad?
No.
Have you heard of Shahrazad? 1001 Nights?
Yeah.
Shahrazad 1001 Nights is a story. I think it's a very good story. She's a young maiden and living in a place where the king or caliph or whoever picks up a young maiden every night, the best there is in town, and calls her in and has an evening of pleasure with her, and then slits her throat every night. And then the turn comes to the daughter of one of his ministers. Now, and her name is Shahrazad, and the king tells her father, you know, send your daughter over. And the daughter comes, but she's a bit clever. And so, and she knows what the king is after.
Okay, she knows what's about to happen.
Yes. Okay. What? No, not what's about to happen. What happens usually.
Okay.
And so she wants to change the direction.
Yes.
So she starts telling a tale to the king. And it's so exciting, the tale, that the king at the end falls asleep, but the tale isn't finished. He falls asleep, the night passes, they're waking up the next morning, the night is over. The king wants to wait until the evening and hear the rest of the tale, what happened. So she goes on, night after night after night after night, 1001 nights. At the end, the idea is that they actually come to see a way for both to live together, with the king changing his previous kind of dispositions, psychotic views of things.
Huh.
Now the question comes up, it comes up in my case, came up like this. So first night she was able to put him to sleep. Why didn't Shahrazad get a knife into the bedroom boudoir with her and then kill him while he was asleep? She could have actually prepared this in conspiracy with her father, who was in the court. Everybody was against the king. Maybe they could have arranged a coup d'etat against him and used her cleverness to get there. And then I decided the real message in the story of Shahrazad is that if she had done that and killed him and somebody else came and took his place very quickly, the next person who took his place would be just as bad or worse than he was.
A vicious cycle.
A vicious cycle. The only way to get violence over violence is to somehow slowly use conversation, use understanding, use psychology if you like, use patience until you get to the point where you make sure there's no violence to be followed, to come after.
It's a nice story. How do you make this into reality here? How do you get Ben-Gvir and Hamas talking for 1,001 nights?
I'm not sure about Ben-Gvir and Hamas as such. I mean, you know, people have different ideologies.
Like Bibi and Hamas.
You continue standing, you know, your ground, mm-hmm. Not using violence, and trying to create conversations. Now, what's happening here in the country between Israelis and Palestinians is, on the one hand, what you see, the drama of the violence being used against Palestinian structures, farmers, you name it. But on the other hand, what you see is Palestinian laborers, for instance, trying to jump over the wall, you know, the wall that they've put up, often getting shot at by Israeli soldiers. But day after day, they'll try to do it in order to get over the wall and go and find a job in an Israeli building site. Mm-hmm. And if they do, if they get there and start working like they did in the past, you'll find that the relations between them and the people, you know, on the other side, Israelis, are actually good relations. Mm-hmm. If you go to various institutions like hospitals, people say that you will find that there you have a lot of Palestinians working in hospitals side by side with the Jews. Mm-hmm. Go to other institutions, you find businessmen working together. So this is a reality that sort of sits behind the dramatic reality of violence that we see, which tells you that if we can peel off the surface of violence, that behind that we can get to a place where normal human beings on both sides can actually get on very well together. And, you know, if you look at Israelis and you look at Palestinians, many of them, you know, very often you'll find you can't distinguish between them. Not only in their looks, but even in their habits.
Like, back to the political level, the political leaders, is it easier for the political leaders to choose violence than talk? Because they want, like in Israel, they want to get reelected.
Yeah. I mean, you know, political leaders are usually people who want to become leaders or stay leaders. And, you know, violence is a kind of attractive way because they can't do very much else to their people. And so they choose violence. But the average person, I think, like yourself, I mean, are you a violent person? No.
No.
I think most people, the average people, are not. Are not violent.
I'm scared of it.
You're scared of violence?
Yes. I was scared yesterday.
Down in Jericho?
Yeah.
Well, you should come and stay here for longer periods. And then you sort of, it's a psychological way of dealing with it. You
get used to it.
You get used to it. You start sort of knowing how to live in between moments of violence, in between moments of drama. The thing is, you wouldn't choose a life like that, but on the other hand, you know, given the fact that you have a life like this, the thing is, you know, what do you choose to do about it? Do you choose to go and use violence yourself, knowing that it will never end, it will just continue? Mm-hmm. Not with yourself, maybe with your kids, and your grandkids. So do you do that, or do you try and find, and it sounds much more rational to try and find a suitable coexistence.
And do you think, or do you mean that, you know, Israelis and Palestinian leaders should decide, okay, let's talk instead of use violence for once? Or is there like a responsibility by the international community, especially like Israeli supporters or supporters of Israel, like Germany, the US? Like, can we force the Israelis or like pressure them into talking?
You know, I mean, a lot of Palestinians and Israelis think that this is the, you know, this is what's needed, that you need Israeli friends, international friends of Israel to come and pressure Israel.
Yeah. I mean, without American help, Israel, their military's fucked.
I'm not personally totally convinced by that, by the way. I think at the end of the day, the problem is between the Israeli and the Palestinian. And it's the Israeli and the Palestinian that have to deal with the situation directly amongst themselves, between them. And I think that Israel...
Like in their own time, without foreign pressure.
Unfortunately, in their own time. I mean, you have to go through the process. You have to...
It's been 60 years, sorry.
But things can go on for hundreds of years in this part of the world, right?
Yes.
And it's actually, you know, why go in for a quick solution? I mean, you need something, of course, that will maintain as much stability, peace as possible. But at the same time, you should look forward to a time and work towards creating a time when there will be real peace, when both sides will be perfectly happy, satisfied with the kind of peace that they've created for themselves. By the way, if you look back, for instance, at Oslo, the Oslo Agreement,
Yeah. Well,
that was very strange. I mean, it came after a lot of fighting between the two sides, and Hamas was there, and everybody else and the soldiers were there, and we were hitting at each other and beating each other up. Rabin himself was calling for breaking the bones of Palestinian boys. I don't know if you've come across that.
No.
Oh, yes. Just before he actually changed his attitude and decided we can't beat the struggle for peace and for independence by breaking people's bones. And we have to speak to the Palestinians. And that's what he did. And that's what actually made him special, what made him stand out in Israel as a leader who could, in fact, take the courageous step forward.
He got killed for it.
And he got killed, Sadat got killed. Yeah, I mean, some people who get killed are good people. And it's because they're good they're killed.
But like, if you, like, any compromise will be dissatisfying for the radicals on both sides, right?
Yes.
So but there's always like the chance of new violence.
Yes, but look, I mean, you had a situation where for how many years? Since 67 till about 87, 88, that's about 20, 22 years, when there's confrontation only, primarily between Palestinians and Israelis, demonstrations, killings, detentions, imprisonments, you name it. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the first intifada, the first major intifada in the occupied territories, and you know this position of Rabin that I should break their bones, then suddenly a whole transformation, a twist. The leaders say we want to make peace, and the people, a critical mass of the people on both sides, say we are with you,
yeah.
And they go forward and they try to make peace. It fails, unfortunately, because they couldn't negotiate the two sides in a way that they didn't use the opportunity given them. But what that shows is that it's possible to transform a situation of violence into one of possible peace building.
I mean, you just mentioned the first intifada at the end of the 80s. Mm. You were a leader in it, right?
People say that. I was involved, certainly.
Non-violently?
In my case, yes, non-violent.
But it was the first intifada. It was a violent.
It wasn't actually. No, it wasn't. I mean, there were people who were trying to make it violent.
Okay.
There's always this happening, but I was pushing for a non-violent program, basically reaching the situation where we can declare independence, where we can actually start our civil administration by ourselves, even without, and then reach to a negotiation with Israel. That was the program. It consisted of two parts. Mm-hmm. One part was what I, in mind, had called disengagement from the Israeli system of occupation. That's to say, not pay them taxes, not work in their offices or their organizations, mm-hmm. not deal with them, not accept the permits and non-permits, and create your own. And that was the build-up. So there's disengagement, and there was civilian build-up, reaching the point where we declare independence and we call for negotiations with Israel for a two-state solution. That was the whole thing. And yes, the idea was non-violence. It has to be non-violence. But there are people among Palestinians who wanted violence. Hamas had already also begun forming itself at that point in time, by the way. And there were problems with Hamas at the time between people who wanted this and people who wanted that. But on the whole, I think the majority ruled. The majority was for peace. And that brought the PLO, Arafat, into the West Bank.
Did people like consider you a leader, or did you want to be a leader during that time?
I didn't want to be a leader, and I didn't show myself off as a leader either. So, and at the time, if I had shown myself to be a leader, I would have ended up in jail.
Which you did in 1991.
But for totally different reasons, because they didn't have the real evidence to use against me in any way.
Well, did they tell you eventually after they let you out after 3 months what they charged you with?
No, no. You look, I mean, I know what they did because they came to...
In here?
No, no. They didn't. Well, no, I wasn't here. I was somewhere else. They came. Of course, the soldiers came, surrounded the house, picked me up and took me in the middle of the night. And I wasn't sure what was happening. Of course, I had no idea why they did this. Because by then, at the time, I had actually stopped my active involvement in the First Intifada. But anyway, the reason they picked me up then, they said, was because they heard a telephone call that I made with somebody in the PLO outside who had the Iraqi ambassador sitting next to him. And he passed him the phone and asked me to talk to this guy. And the guy was asking me, you know, we are for the Palestinians and how are you? So I was talking to him. But, you know, I am not stupid. I was talking to people left, right, and center on the phone, knowing that everything I said was nothing sort of secret, you know. And but they came and accused me of being an Iraqi spy at the time. Oh. I mean, but that wasn't a proper accusation. It was a public relations kind of thing. First night, they took me into the cell by myself. It was in a civilian compound at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was scared because I thought, my God, these are rockets, you know, falling on Israel, and people will associate me with a rocket terrorist. And the first thing that happened to me was a man, a civil... criminal, they called, someone who, you know, with a scarred face, probably a drug addict or a drug seller pusher or something like this, I don't know what. And they had a radio, you know, he could have a radio with him, who came up to the cell and looked at me and said to me, "Do you hear what these bastards are talking about you?" At the time, Netanyahu was the representative of Israel at the United Nations.
Oh.
And Netanyahu was accusing, saying, you know, bragging that they'd caught this spying, and, you know, I was one of these guys. And this guy, who belongs to the underworld in Israel, with whom I had nothing to do, you know, for all the previous years, comes to me and says, "Do you hear that? What these bastards are talking about you?" So he's attacking his government and actually realizing that the government action against me was unjust. Now, it was very soothing for me. I mean, to know that at least there's someone on the other side who understands what the situation really is like.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Like you mentioned, you know, regarding the First Intifada, that Hamas was a new player.
Yes.
Like at the time, did you realize what kind of player they could become? They were like basically the opposition to Arafat and the Fatah, right?
They had started, you know, the Islamic movement started appearing before. Mm-hmm. And already when I was at Birzeit, I was teaching there in the 80s, they were beginning to develop, beginning to grow, the Islamic movement in the campuses across the West Bank, Gaza, as a kind of opposition to the, to the mainstream national movement. And we had problems with them, you know, in the mid-80s. And I had problems with them in general. Now, when the Intifada started, I could see that they have turned themselves into a front, an active front on the ground. alongside the front of the national movement. And yes, I could see there was a problem. And indeed, there were some actually infighting that took place between the two sides. And at one stage, early on, inside jails, there was a problem between people in Hamas and people in the national movement. And it was going to spread out in the rest of the occupied territories. So something had to be done. And I imagined recall that there was a very quick way to sort of try and contain it by producing a joint kind of communique between the national movement and Hamas that quietened things down. But, you know, to the extent that the national movement failed to deliver to the people what it promised, the Hamas movement, of course, grew in strength and power. And it has until we saw what happened in Gaza recently. So, unfortunately, the use of force actually right from the outset, not just by Hamas, but even by the national movement right from the outset. For me, as an onlooker, observer, if you like, with some sanity in my head, was never something that was up my alley or to my taste. And I always knew that this is not the way to go. Which is why even early on in the 80s, I called for Israel to annex us.
We're going to talk about that.
Okay.
But like, you remember what your day was like on October 7th, 2023?
Do I remember what it was like?
Yeah. How did it feel when you saw?
I want to tell you something. Although I have a television screen here, I don't watch the news at all.
Yeah. It's a nice TV.
It's a very nice TV, and I only watch Korean, series. Romantic or science fiction or something like this. This is
Korean.
They're very soothing. You know, everything is good at the end. You know that you go to heaven, regardless what happens in between.
Do you recommend me some stuff later?
I don't know. You can go into them, but
you didn't.
So I know started. What was going I start. No, I started getting, of course, on WhatsApp and so on, and seeing what there is. I don't form opinions quickly, and so I wasn't sure what was happening. I didn't really digest exactly what happened with what the Palestinians were doing to the Israelis, for instance, the first 24 hours or less, 12 hours. I didn't know what Hamas was up to, why it was doing what it was doing. And I kind of suspended my judgment about this whole thing. You know, a lot of people on the Palestinian side around me were, wow, you know, look, we're doing things. Yes, I could see that Hamas has done something with, you know, Palestinian military or violent resistance hadn't done before, but I wasn't sure at all about where it will lead. That's apart from, you know, what they did in the first 24 hours, but as a strategy or as a policy.
Yeah.
I wasn't really sure. I still, you know, till today, of course, I'm not sure. But it certainly, you know, made things worse, I think, for us.
So Hamas did, I mean, besides massacring Israelis, they did a disservice to the Palestinian people?
Well, of course, don't you think so?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
many Palestinians don't. Or Palestine supporters in the West. I know people who, you know,
Palestinian supporters in the West are not in, you know, people usually are more royal than the king, really, when, you know, when they're, you know, further away from the scene, so to speak, yes. They're more royal than the king. And this is how it is. The idea simply that, you know, there's a wrong and a right here. Now, this from a distance seems very clear that there's a wrong. The wrong is Israel's occupation of us. Israel's creation, actually, also is seen as a wrong. I can go into this if you like. And then there's the right. The right is the Palestinians who have been taken over, whose land has been gobbled up, who've been And, you know, what can they do? The only thing they can do is resist and fight and shoot and so on. And shooting and fighting is a rightful thing to do.
Yeah.
And this is how the picture is looked at or seen. And so it's easy, you know, it's easy to say from a distance, you know, this was Hamas. I mean, forget Islam and Muslim and whatever, but this was a military attempt by the Palestinians under occupation.
An act of resistance to the occupation.
That's right. That's right. And or opposition or something. Yeah. I mean, it's easy to see that, I think, unless you're prejudiced. Are you? You see, you can be prejudiced on one side or on the other. So you should be careful.
Hey Leute, kurzer Hinweis. Wir stellen ja alles, was wir produzieren, kostenlos ins Netz. Ohne Kommerz. Wir können das nur, weil ihr unsere finanziellen Supporter seid. Das funktioniert seit Jahren und so soll es bleiben. Jeder Euro zählt, per Überweisung oder PayPal. Schaut einfach in die Podcast-Beschreibung und jetzt geht's weiter.
When did you realize that the Israeli response to October 7th would be this tough?
I didn't.
You didn't?
No, I didn't realize it'd be this tough. I thought they were more sane. But the Israelis, really? The Israelis went mad. Yes.
Why do you think they went mad?
Why?
Yes.
Well, there are two reasons, I think. The shock, I think, of being penetrated, which is something that for them was a totally... how can I put it? Totally unexpected, unforeseen thing that could never happen. You created Israel to provide a safe haven for the Jews.
Yes.
And you create this army, which is the strongest in the region, maybe further, in order to protect Jews. And then suddenly, you know, your wall is penetrated, broken. And the security of the Jews is under threat. It's a shock. It's a shocking thing. I mean, the whole project of Zionism of Israel is to prevent this from happening.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing. And so the reaction was that of and then of course the killings, the massacres, as you put it, of the Israelis. I mean, I didn't see, but a lot of them apparently. Women maybe raped to begin with.
Yes.
A massacre is a massacre, a murder is a murder, you know, whoever it is committed by. And if I were, you know, on the Israeli side seeing this happening to me, I'd be also very, very angry about that. So you put the two together and then you have this this sort of anger, this reaction by Israel. Now, there's a third element, though. And the third element is a political one, and it's not in the calculations of people who react immediately to what happened. And this third element has to do with, you know, maybe we can use the opportunity to get rid of the Palestinians, to take more territory. And I think this is what...
That's what Smotrich said, like, right after, right?
That's right. And I think that's, you know, certain, I would say certain sectors within the army, within the political echelon, probably thought this to be a good thing. So this was a kind of cynical way of looking at things. You know, I mean, let me put it this way. Let's assume Smotrich said this. So Smotrich really wasn't so much angered or so much really, but he thought it was a good thing to use in order to take more territory. And you know, this is a cynical political kind of thing. So you have all these reactions. At the same time, there wasn't enough, let me put it, not something against what happened, but at least something to present a different point of view on the Palestinian side. There wasn't a sufficiently clear position on the Palestinian side to say, certainly not by the authority, and the authority was in a position actually responsible for standing up and saying exactly what should have been said at the time, which is to denounce the actual attack.
Yeah.
Before denouncing the reaction to the attack, the genocidal reaction to the attack,
yes.
The first thing you should denounce is the attack itself,
yes.
Which is a murderous attack.
Yes.
And that would justify your defense later. But both sides...
Should not be hypocritical.
Yes, but look, both sides, are hypocritical, or were in this case.
And those sides need to talk, as we talked about.
And both sides, yes, need to settle down, because it's more important to try and build a future that is livable than to prove hubris or prove power, to prove you're right or prove, you know, whatever. So talking is the way to go forward.
Why do you think it's a genocide in Gaza?
Why?
Yes.
Why is there a genocide?
I mean, there are Israeli NGOs calling it a genocide. There's a UN independent commission founding four or five.
Forget about legal terms, because that's what people started arguing about. And then it became an academic issue. It became an issue to be discussed in universities, you know, between philosophers of law and human rights. Is this genocide or not? What does it matter? I don't think it matters. I don't care what you call it, actually. But there are certain facts that you have to face. And one fact is that so many people were killed, civilians, clearly in a blood rage, in a murderous massacres.
Right.
Clearly there's a political plan behind it, or project, or hope, if you like, which is to empty Gaza of Palestinians. Mm-hmm. There is the sense that maybe we are next here, you know, in the West Bank and in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And only today I was actually listening to a report about, and by an Israeli, I can't remember his name, about Jordan being next. And, you know, it's a question of time.
Like after Lebanon and all that?
Sorry. Yeah, because, you know, if the idea is to kick us out, well, you kick people out from Gaza into Egypt. Egypt is sort of resisting that, and so it's not really happening as you want. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you can kick us out in this direction to the east. Maybe it's possible. And, you know, what the settlers are doing all over the place is just, as everybody says, I mean, not me, obviously a way to try and make us leave. Now, what does genocide mean? It means getting rid of a people. So, however you get rid of them, you know, you can call it genocide, or you can call it what you like.
I'm going to add one thing, because like Germany is part of the Genocide Convention of 1948.
Yeah, and for a good reason.
This convention is, part of it is preventing genocide.
Yes.
And if there are rational aspects that you can, you know, like the ICJ ruled in 2024 that there's a danger that this could be a genocide, and they made, that there were measures against Israel to prevent it.
Yes.
Which Israel hasn't fully complied by. And because there's a duty for signing members like Germany, like the European members, to prevent it, and the ICJ saying, okay, there's a danger of a genocide happening, this means like countries who are supporting Israel, like my country, they are obliged. Mm-hmm. They are obliged to change their politics, like not sending weapons, not helping them on a diplomatic level. So that's why it, like in my opinion, the words matter. And
I understand your opinion, and I understand your reasons for holding the opinion.
As a German,
as a human being, as a person with values, you have to understand my perspective. And my perspective as a Palestinian who has gone through a lot of UN resolutions and positions, has had lots of meetings with all kinds of representatives of different pro-Israel and anti-Israel governments, and this and that, and have heard promises left, right, and center for many, many years. You know, I'm totally, and have, you know, the father as a lawyer who believed in law, and I have cousins, my sons also. I'm totally cynical about everything to do with all these regulations and laws that are written everywhere in Europe and America and elsewhere and in this country. I think they are unfortunately tools that are used to the benefit and use according to governments and leaders' interests at different times. Can be used, can be not used, yeah. Can be so. And one shouldn't sort of rely on them, which means not that one should stop talking or asking or shouting.
Sure.
But it means that nonetheless, one should look for one's solutions in one's enemy or with one's enemy.
Sure.
That's why I think Israelis and Palestinians must actually solve the problem together.
But like as a German, you mean this convention was created after the Holocaust of, yeah, you know, yeah, my forefathers against, yeah, the Jewish people.
Yeah.
And we were raised as in like, okay, never again,
yeah,
must the German country, the German state do this, you know, no genocide ever again, no harm of Jews and Jewish life, and so on and so on. And that's why, like, we must not be hypocritical. And we try to, like, because like the German politician, the German establishment is very pro-Israel, you know, for reasons that everybody can understand. But they also made sure for decades to hold up international law. Like there's the founding members of the ICJ, of the ICC and all this. So we want to take them by their words. And like, okay, this must not ever happen again. So we use their own words against them to not be hypocritical.
Yeah, but you know,
I'm naive.
You're not naive, but you are actually. I mean, I think there's a general consensus developed that the so-called international order set up to begin with after First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And that has now been ruling us so peacefully and nicely and justly for the last 90, 70 years, suddenly that it's breaking up.
Mm.
Now, you know, the Second World War is only part of this. And the conventions after the, after the war are part of this. But, you know, everything is actually broken now. It's fractured, all this order. Now, we have to learn a lesson from this. And the lesson is that, unfortunately, countries, states behave or act in accordance with their immediate interests.
Yeah.
And with their hunger for power, for expansion, for all kinds of things like that. And so not to expect too much from them. One should continue to struggle,
yeah,
within one's own country, one's own government, one's own society, to, you know, abide by human values and rules and so on. But one, I don't think, should deceive oneself into thinking that these things will any time soon be the savior, because they're not. They're going to be a long time ahead of us to try and actually establish or re-establish an order of values,
right,
that people will really stick to in different countries. And yeah, I mean, sorry, and Jews, you know, Jews have had problems, not just with Germany, you know. I mean, Jews have had a problem. I mean, they have, I don't know why, but they have had a problem throughout their history.
Yeah.
And something needs to be done so as to provide the haven that they've been searching for, that has actually, to go back to earlier part of the conversation, I think this is something, for instance, we Palestinians have to realize.
Mm-hmm.
Because of a lot of Palestinians just tell you, you know, we know what happened with the Jews in Germany, but why are we the Palestinians to blame, right? But it is not enough for us to say that. It is important for us. And that's part of the steps we have to take towards a solution, towards a kind of mutual understanding between ourselves and Israelis. We have to take the further step of really understanding that the injustice that we feel has been done to us, which is the creation of Israel, from Israel's point of view, was viewed as the only just thing for them to do, to create a safe haven for themselves. And so we have to get there. I mean, we have to get over our psychological problems of understanding Israel, and Israel has to get over some of its problems in understanding us.
I read a quote from you, like you basically said, like Israelis thinking prioritizes security over freedom, and Palestinian thinking prioritizes freedom over security for all.
Well, this is the description of how things have going. I mean, the Israelis, for them, you have to have the wall, the army, the so on, and you know, as a result of getting all of that and being happy and satisfied with it, they think, you know, then we can take the next step and make peace with the Palestinians. The Palestinians feel, you know, we are under a lot of what they call their security, but under their boots. We want to get rid of the boots, want to breathe our lives freely, and once we do, we can then build peace with the Israelis. This is how it is, and it will never work.
Like, I mean, once you were, like, in the 80s, I think you were, let's go, let's put it this way. You were supportive of a one-state solution once, then you changed your opinion, and you were supportive of a two-state solution, and then you went back to a one-state solution. Is that correct?
I support any kind of solution, right?
No. What's your ideal?
The one that is most rational, that can bring peace to all. Now, look, it started out in the very, very beginning. I was in favor of one state because this is how I grew up. As a young 17, 18-year guy kind of person. I looked at Israel as everybody else at that age. A lot of people this age today look at it as a colonialist, whatever, and imperialist design or project and that is wrong and so on. So I thought we have to dismantle the structure of the state and create a state in which all people in it are equal, Jews, non-Jews, Muslims, Christians, whatever. And so in 1967, when Israel took over the West Bank and won in the army, and a lot of Palestinians were unhappy, I felt happy because suddenly there was no wall at the back of the house here. Literally, and you know, I could go into what I was brought up to believe was an essential part of my country. And I thought, well, the wall now is broken, we can now really live in one country, and so we should work towards that end. And then when I started teaching here, I looked around, I saw the students, people really didn't want anything to do with Israel, and they wanted to be free and rid of the occupation. So what did they want? They wanted a state. So I said, okay, I will go along with having a state. Makes maybe sense to have a state next to a state, if the Israelis will accept such a state, and I worked for that. And then I saw that actually that whole plan doesn't seem to be realistic, and it's falling by the wayside for different reasons, until we got us to this point. In the meantime, I said the different ways of doing things, even now. So at one stage, I suggested, for instance, that Israel just provide everybody in the West Bank, Gaza, under occupation with civil rights, the rights that I have in Jerusalem. So, you know, push off one state, push off two states. Let's just begin with a system where people have just basic civil rights. And down the line, it can be decided, you know, once the situation is better, people want to go into two states or one state as they like. And, you know, I still have that in my mind. You know, I'm happy to go in any direction.
I remember, like, the first time we were here, 2014, and I went to the West Bank, I talked to a Palestinian businessman, Sam Bahour.
I know him, yeah.
And like he gave me a new idea that I hadn't had before. I don't know if he still holds it, but it was basically Palestinian leaders need to drop the idea of a state of Palestine and start demanding civil rights. You know, turn this entire issue into a civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Like, bow down to Israel. Be like, okay, everything is Israel.
But he was by civil rights, he means also political rights? Or
yes,
just civil?
Yes.
Just political rights.
Same rights.
Same rights. I've been doing that since the 70s or whatever. Yeah.
But the Palestinian leaders and many people, they want still a state.
It's a bit more difficult. The idea of two states is an intellectual project created consciously, not popular to begin with among Palestinians, that had to be drummed into people's minds over years for them to start saying Palestinian state next to Israel. They were not born as two-staters, the Palestinians. The first person who ever said two states actually had the national movement send somebody to blow up the car that he had or the house that he had. And it was, you know, it was a long process in the 80s, late 70s. I mean, I remember it, of trying to convince people, Palestinians, no, let's go for two states, that's enough for us.
Like, as a naive guy, when I was younger, I always thought, like, how would this even work? I mean, there's the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and then on the other side of Israel, then there's Gaza. Like, how can you have like a Palestinian state that consists of different territories that are not connected? You know,
what does connection mean? I mean, it's all kinds of things. I mean, you have many examples, political examples, actually, of states, especially in Eastern Europe now, which are not properly connected. But look, a lot of stuff was done, a lot of work was done. I was involved in some of the work to establish, during the 80s, 90s, to establish the conception of a two-state solution. And a lot of details were worked out between Israelis and Palestinians. Not only at the negotiating level, you know, but also in the back rooms with technicians on both sides. So the idea is not impossible, and it's actually it's been proven to be doable in theory. And but unfortunately, the negotiations didn't take us there, and we kept slipping and slipping and slipping, and it's become more and more difficult. And now we're in a situation where, unless a miracle happens, and you know, this is a place where it is possible that this happens, I think the two-state conception no longer is valid for the moment. And maybe the most valid thing to work for at the moment is some kind of interim situation that will calm a situation for the next few years.
What part does the PA play? You know, Abbas, I mean, he's freaking old. There haven't been any elections lately. Like, what about those leaders and their, I mean, they you know, are for their own state and all this. Maybe there needs to be a change. I mean, I remember Bahour telling me, like, all right, Abbas needs to die. Like, once he's dead, then we can have a new kind of movement within.
I don't know. I mean, I think that, a lot of people will say about this about Netanyahu, you know, you need him to die or somehow lose and then things will happen.
I doubt that, actually.
So do I. And I think, you shouldn't trust, this thought that Abbas might die tomorrow or soon. He's got a long life ahead of him.
But are you friends?
No, I don't even interact with him. He doesn't like me.
Why?
I've never... We had a fallout on the question of negotiations between Israel and him, and especially in to do with refugees.
Yeah.
And it was a time when I was actually closely associated with, and I was going to attend meetings, and I was talking about refugees that we had to, it was with Ayalon plan, that the refugees do not go into Israel.
You co-founded the People's Voice with along with
People's Voice, yes, and you know, and so people were sort of complaining, and then one day Abu Mazen comes into the meeting and he says to Arafat, you know, I want to add, you know, you ask, Arafat asks people, you know, do you have to add anything to the agenda? And Abu Mazen says, well, I'd like to add, say, what? Sari's comments. And so Arafat, okay, adds Sari's comments. Time comes, Abu Mazen starts, to begin with, giving me a sort of soft talk that I shouldn't be saying what I'm saying or announcing what I'm announcing. And so, just as softly, I respond and continue. And slowly, he sort of moves up his tone. And in the end, he says, you know, I'm not just conversing or discussing or negotiating with you. I'm ordering you to do such and such, to stop making the kind of statements that you make. And I told him, I'm very sorry, but I don't work for you. And I said, I work for the guy next to you. You know, I pointed at Arafat. And that sort of really, you know, made him angry. And Arafat, of course, didn't back him up. And so he associates me with a kind of the sort of Fatah fallen, you know, I don't know what you call them, people with Arafat or pro-Arafat. So I've never really had a good relationship with them. Before that, I used to, when they were in Tunis, I respected them actually. So, and I was hoping, you know, I had a lot of hope in him.
Is he a good leader like Arafat? No. Was Arafat a better leader?
Well,
was he a good leader at all? Both of them.
You know, he's a good sort of Stalinist leader, if you see what I mean. I mean, he's good at machinations, conspiracies, you know, gearing things up. But he doesn't have the charisma that Arafat had. He can't get people behind him the way Arafat could have. People don't actually, you know, they don't see him as being part of them, I think. He's not connected.
Because he's a Stalinist, he knows how to get rid of his rivals?
He gets rid of his rivals, yes. But also the...
That's why you didn't stay close, huh?
I stayed away and you know, and I'm happy here where I am away from him.
Yes. Should... I mean, even Palestinian, you know, the Palestinian diaspora in the West or in other parts of the world, and Palestinian here, they want the right to do return whenever there's a, you know, some a solution, you know, one state, whatever. But they want the Palestinian diaspora have, you know, the right to return, just like Jews from all over the world can become an Israeli citizen. You're against it?
I think the Palestinians have the right to return.
To where?
To Palestine. But the Palestinians also have other rights. And one of the other rights is to create a state for themselves. Is to create a state in which they can look after themselves, in which they can build up a future. And so you have a problem if one right conflicts with another. In this particular situation, they do. They conflict with one another. So what do you do? Do you just let both rights go? Or do you, you know, take hold of the right that you can bring about and make? And so I'm in favor of the right of creating a state, independence. Freedom for the Palestinians, a future, at the expense of another right I have, which is that of return. Now look, it looks or sounds difficult, but it's very straightforward. I have a right to go here, and I have a right to go there. But very often, these rights are mutually exclusive. If I actually exercise my right to go here, I sort of forego the ability of executing my right to go there. And it's understandable. There's no problem. And we have to understand it. And it's something I've tried, actually, in the past to explain. Because it isn't just enough to tell Palestinians who want to return that I have the right to return. No, you don't have the right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. And it isn't enough to say, forget it. And it's not enough to hide anything from them. And this is my problem with at the time with Abu Mazen and with the leadership. Because I was saying to them, look, we have been negotiating with the Israelis, knowing fully well that we're not going to be asking, pushing for the right of return. This is early on in Oslo, right? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of committees were set up. One of them was about refugees. And I was in a position to know what the discussions were taking place between this side and that side. And I knew that there wasn't going to be a push for returning the refugees. So why don't you tell the people what you are doing? This is the problem.
It's unpopular.
But you have to face it. If you are a leader, you have to convince. You can't be led, you have to lead. Yes. And look, I'll tell you a story. In the time, it was, I think, it was the previous time I was making those statements, whenever it was, 2002, 4, I can't remember. And some people from one of the refugee camps near Bethlehem called me up, said, "Sir, we want to have a talk with you. And about your comments or observations or declarations." So I went to a meeting. I was asked to attend the meeting. There were about 20, 30 people or activists at the time, all still armed. And I was there, you know. Of course, you know, I was terrified, scared. But as, you know, we said earlier, to be scared is part of living normal life.
Yeah.
And but I knew that if I didn't go, I would not be able to sleep that night. Mm-hmm. So I went, and we had a long 3-hour, I think, shouting match with me trying to explain things rationally and politically, and telling people what we wanted, what I think is best for all of us, for them. So at the end, two or three of the people who had invited me walked up to me and said, "Look, Sari, we want to tell you three things. One thing, first thing is, we haven't bought a single argument that you gave us tonight. We don't agree with anything you say. Second thing we want to tell you is not only this, we are disgusted. We feel disgusted when we hear you making those declarations. But the third thing they said in my face, they said, the third thing we want to tell you is, nonetheless, we respect you for telling us exactly what you think and what we know people behind you think.
And what they needed to hear.
And they needed to hear it. And you need to be able, you see, this is a time when leaders have to face their populations on both sides, of course, and tell them exactly what needs to be done.
We need to do this again at some point. We will, you know, we always come back. But like, two quick questions at the end. We talked about your house, and before we started, like, you told me a little bit about your parents, because, you know, all the pictures here. Is it true that your family has like
a long history.
Centuries of history.
Look, I'm not a historian, but my family members, some of them, claim that we have a long history.
What do they claim?
Well, you should read the book my daughter wrote, mm-hmm. called By the Name of the Woman from Whom We Claim Descent, a woman who lived at the time of the Prophet and fought alongside him.
Right. Prophet Muhammad?
That's him. Yeah. And so we are supposed to have descended from her, coming to Jerusalem at that time, when they came, the people from there to Jerusalem, and we've held offices in Jerusalem in different from that time. And so we're supposed to be a very, very old family.
Do you believe it?
You know, to the extent one likes to hear and likes fairy tales and so on. I'm not a historian. I mean, it may be true. I have no idea. But
We talked about a fairy tale earlier.
Absolutely, exactly. I'm not sure.
Does it matter to you?
It doesn't. You know, I like, and I encourage my family members to think like I do, which is built for tomorrow, your present and your tomorrow. And, you know, the past is past, whether it's good or bad.
We didn't get a chance to talk about your philosophy. As a philosopher, how would you describe your philosophy? Because I can imagine you haven't only thought about Palestine and Israel and all this. What kind of philosophical thinking have you been doing the last 40 years? What school of thought are you part of?
I don't have a school of thought. I believe that the other day I was in a book launch for one of my books about philosophy in Arabic. I was in Bethlehem, in Tantour, actually. And, you know, and there I told people in the that one of the things that I believe is that everyone has a little philosopher inside of us. And the philosopher is just a person that thinks. And so philosophizing is thinking. So don't take up Kant or Hegel or I don't know what or Schopenhauer or go Anglo-Saxon or French. Just think. Yeah. Think your own questions. Try to answer your own questions. And if you are trained to do this, then you'd be trained as a good philosopher.
Let's leave it at that.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Thanks for watching, guys. Thanks for hearing this interview. And thanks for supporting our show. Bye-bye.
Have some of this.
I will try.